It's Tuesday, July 1st. Glad you've clicked on the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. I'm Phil Picardi. Coming up on the podcast, Minnesotans react to a big Supreme Court ruling. FEMA gauges the flood damage. Teachers at Twin Cities charter schools want to unionize. Minneapolis is looking to fill police department vacancies. And Her Honor talks about her first few months on the job. First, the U.S. Supreme Court's opinion on the mandate to cover birth control affects at least seven Minnesota court cases. Each involves a company whose owners say the government's requirement to provide health insurance covering certain forms of birth control violates their religious beliefs. Elizabeth Stewicki reports.
Minneapolis attorney Eric Cardall brought seven Minnesota cases challenging the mandate. Calling the high court ruling a watershed moment, he said the decision is a victory for people with religious objections to government policies. At the same time, he says the Supreme Court ruling doesn't threaten the birth control mandate. Cardall says the high court doesn't provide an automatic exemption from the mandate for the family-owned or closely held businesses he represents, but he is confident that the ruling bodes well for his clients.
The U.S. Supreme Court case has substantially the same facts as the Protestant Catholic business owners I'm representing.
One of those cases is pending before the U.S. Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals. Annex Medical of Minnetonka designs, manufactures, and sells medical devices. Like the plaintiffs in the Supreme Court case, the firm's owners believe that paying for a group health insurance plan that includes contraception, sterilization, and Plan B, sometimes called the morning after pill, violates their religious beliefs. Annex, like the lead plaintiff in the Supreme Court case, sued even though the company's existing health plan covered the contraceptives the company owners found objectionable. Cardall says the company owners weren't aware the health plans they provided violated their religious beliefs. He says it wasn't until the Affordable Care Act made it a requirement that they started asking questions.
The insurance policies are complicated, and sometimes the specific coverages, like your contraceptives and so forth, they're not mentioned in the insurance policies. And a few of my clients didn't understand that.
The High Court's opinion notes that if Hobby Lobby, the lead plaintiff, chose not to provide the contraceptive coverage the Affordable Care Act requires, the company's taxes would jump by nearly $500 million. While some businesses are overjoyed at the High Court's decision, others, such as Planned Parenthood, called it outrageous. Sarah Stace, president and CEO of Planned Parenthood Minnesota, North Dakota, and South Dakota, says the organization is deeply disappointed and frustrated.
Now, some women's bosses are going to be able to interfere with employees' access to birth control. And birth control is important for women, not just so that they can plan their families, but also so that they can address underlying health conditions.
In dissent, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg notes that pregnancy can be medically risky for women with certain medical conditions, such as some heart conditions. Just what the ruling will mean for Minnesota's health plans is unclear right now. Eileen Smith of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans says what is clear-cut is that health plans will have to follow the law, but beyond that...
Now, this ruling does not impact all employers, so it's important that the plans determine with their legal teams what the ruling is, how it impacts specific products and specific employers that they work with.
While the Supreme Court's ruling answers one question, it does raise other questions about opening the door to other religious exemptions from federal laws. For example, a wedding photographer or florist that objects to participating in a same-sex wedding.
This decision leaves room for them to make an argument. Whether they prevail, I don't know.
University of St. Thomas law professor Tom Berg.
This doesn't decide those cases, but it does say they all have to be weighed on their facts with religious freedom taken seriously.
The High Court says the ruling today does not provide a shield for employers who might cloak illegal discrimination as a religious practice. Meanwhile, attorney Eric Cardall says he'll probably wait to hear how the U.S. Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals rules on the Annex Medical case before deciding his next step.
That's Elizabeth Stewicki. While many of the rivers across the state have crested, a handful of residents and volunteers around Prior Lake spent last night sandbagging. Peter Cox reports.
Several residents in the city of Prior Lake are still sandbagging to keep the lake from overflowing onto their properties. Some streets around the lake are closed to through traffic. Sections of road are still sitting under several feet of water. City Manager Frank Boyles says it will take a longer time to drain the flooding because the city is dealing with a lake, not a river.
In this case, this is not something that's going to go away very soon.
Prior Lake does have an outlet to help it drain, but the area's watershed flows into the lake, so it is difficult to decrease the lake level quickly. Peter Cox, Minnesota Public Radio News, Prior Lake.
As floodwaters recede across the state, cities and counties are tallying up millions of dollars in damage to roads and water treatment systems. Teams from the Federal Emergency Management Agency hit the ground this morning, and state officials expect a federal disaster declaration by the end of the month. Here's Curtis Gilbert.
The threshold for federal assistance is about $7 million in uninsured damage to public infrastructure statewide. Carver County alone has already surpassed that. Emergency manager Deb Page estimates the loss at more than $9 million.
There have been roads washed out and unusable all over the county. It's almost every city and township that have damage to roads.
But it wasn't just the county's roads. The wastewater treatment plant in the city of Norwood, Young America, was overwhelmed when about 9 inches of rain fell over the course of just 2 days. City Administrator Steve Helget says the pumps just couldn't keep up.
Once we got to that point, the breaking point, it just went. Water just came, and there was no stopping it.
The pumps aren't designed to be completely submerged, and their circuits were fried. Estimated cost to fix them? $1 million. And that's not counting the toll the storm took on private property. The city received about 50 calls from residents who had sewage backup into their basements. Hennepin County will need to spend an estimated $6 million on flood-related repairs. Emergency manager Eric Waggy says it's been a tough month.
It is a little different than a typical disaster when people think of a single event. This has been just body blows coming in rapid succession.
The National Weather Service says the Twin Cities area has seen nearly a foot of rain this month, making it the wettest June since 1874. But as bad as the flooding has been for large swaths of Minnesota, State Emergency Management Director Chris Eide says it could have been much worse.
It kind of creeped up instead of rushing in like the one that happened in Duluth a couple of years ago. And then in 2010 and 2007 down in the southeast, it was like 10 inches of rain within 12 hours. That's when you get that horrible flash flooding. That's when your home's float away, and that's really bad.
This time, the worst thing most homeowners saw was water in their basements. That's why it's unlikely the federal government will step in to bail them out. But Eide predicts state and local governments will almost certainly qualify for federal aid. It'll take teams from Eide's office and FEMA about 2 weeks to canvass all the counties affected by the flooding.
Curtis Gilbert on the NPR News Update. Minneapolis-based U.S. Bank will pay $200 million to settle allegations the bank violated Federal Housing Administration requirements. Martin Moylan reports.
The Justice Department says the bank ignored mortgage lending requirements from 2006 through 2011. And the government says that caused substantial losses to taxpayers and contributed to home foreclosures across the country. But Morningstar banking analyst Dan Werder notes the payment is relatively small compared to the bank's nearly $6 billion in profits last year. He says U.S. Bank can come up with the money by selling assets.
Doesn't mean much for their earnings, but it gets a distraction behind them. The quicker you can get these distractions behind them, the better they can focus going forward on their businesses.
The bank said it admits no liability and settled to avoid a long and costly legal battle and distractions to its business. The feds have reached bigger mortgage lending settlements with larger banks. Martin Moylan, Minnesota Public Radio News.
State public safety officials say traffic fatalities last year dropped to their second lowest level in a decade. Mark Zedeklik reports.
State officials say after increasing in 2012, fatal crashes dropped about 2% last year to 387. Deaths on Minnesota roads decreased nearly one-third from just a decade ago. Although deaths were down, the number of crashes jumped by 12% last year. Office of Traffic Safety Director Donna Berger says she's concerned by that trend.
We're seeing the same disturbing contributors to crashes year after year after year. Driver inattention and distraction, failure to yield to the right of way, illegal, unsafe speed, and drunk driving.
Officials say drinking and driving was the top contributing factor in driving fatalities. They say about one-third of those killed were not wearing seat belts, as is required by law. Mark Zedeklik, Minnesota Public Radio News, St. Paul.
The city of Minneapolis celebrates Somali American Day for the first time today. The city council voted to designate July 1st because it's also Somalia's Independence Day. The day highlights the achievements of the Somali American community. Mahmoud Noor is with the Confederation of Somali Community in Minnesota. He says Somali American Day gives Somalis the opportunity to share their culture and traditions with the rest of the community.
A celebration that shows how the city values the diversity and how the community is willing to share, and that reflects our multicultural society.
Noor says many Somalis are Muslim and celebrating Ramadan, so some Somali American Day events took place earlier. In the last 6 months, teachers at two Twin Cities charter schools have voted to unionize. It's an unusual move for charter schools, which in Minnesota have traditionally steered clear of collective bargaining. Now the state's teachers' union sees opportunity in what the union believes is growing dissatisfaction among charter school teachers. Catherine Richard reports.
When a group of charter school teachers frustrated with their school's administration decided to unionize earlier this year, it made news. It also sparked a flurry of phone calls to the union. Those calls came from teachers at other charter schools.
When we get inquiries, more often than not, it's not about money. It's about respect. It's about having that voice. It's about being able to make decisions in your workplace without fear or intimidation.
That's Education Minnesota President Denise Speck. She says those votes present new opportunity for the union. It's hoping to expand its membership to institutions that have typically shunned collective bargaining. The union's two-person organizing staff is now focused on helping teachers at three additional charter schools start the unionization process. They won't say which ones to protect teachers there from retribution. Typically, charter schools have worn their non-unionized status as a badge of honor. They say membership would make it harder to manage their schools the way they want to and to quickly weed out bad teachers. In fact, only 12% nationwide are union members. So in a state that pioneered the charter school movement, that's what makes the two charter schools stand out. Of the 150 charter schools in the state, they're the only ones unionized. But whether those votes mark a new era for the state's teachers' union is up for debate. Union advocates say charter school teachers are increasingly concerned about testing standards. They're worried about pay and view collective bargaining as a way to increase their salaries. And in other cases, there's a conflict between the school's administration and the staff. Susan Johnson is a teacher at the Twin Cities German Immersion School, which voted in January to join Education Minnesota. Among other things, she and her peers are worried about job security.
Due process. If you are an at-will employee, you can be fired because your boss doesn't like the color of your socks.
Recently, unions have made a big push in other states to bring charter schools into their ranks. Aaron Sojourner is a professor at the University of Minnesota and says he expects to see more unionization of charter schools.
Whether it's salary or changes in management or changes in the economic environment, it's a way for them to try to help guide the policy of the school.
Cindy Murphy directs the Minnesota Department of Education's charter school program. The department doesn't take a position on the issue, but she says collective bargaining is an option for school employees who want more say in how their school is operated.
I see the provision of collective bargaining in our state law as just that. It is a provision for charter schools to exercise if it really is best for their local charter school.
The Minnesota Association of Charter Schools said the votes were unique situations. Executive Director Eugene Piccolo points to a change in state law 5 years ago that effectively allows charter schools to limit the number of teachers on their boards. Piccolo said that may be a source of dissatisfaction among charter teachers.
Leadership and governance, I think, are key to whether or not people feel that they have ownership in the school, whether they feel like they're being listened to.
The union isn't the answer for all charter schools that are having disputes. Bemidji-based Schoolcraft Learning teacher Carla Patch said the more she and her coworkers learned about unionization, the more they worried it would upend their school's mission.
I think we felt that we would be giving up some of our autonomy. I think we felt also that we would be giving up some of our community feel.
Patch said conflicts with the administration were resolved, and she and her colleagues have now abandoned the idea of joining Education Minnesota.
Catherine Richard for us. If you want to be a police officer, now is a good time to look for work. That's because veteran law enforcement officers around the state have been retiring early at higher than usual numbers, and police departments are hiring their replacements. Many older officers left before a new pension rule went into effect, which was today. Brant Williams reports.
In Minnesota, law enforcement officers can retire early and start collecting benefits. However, those officers have to pay an early retirement penalty. And that penalty changes for some officers today.
Under the new rules, there's more of a penalty built in for that retirement before the age of 55.
Minneapolis Police Deputy Chief Travis Glampy says the new rule could cost an officer who retires at 50 as much as a fifth of his or her pension over a five-year period. The state's largest police force is feeling the impact of the new rule. 43 officers retired in the first half of this year, compared to an average of 25 to 30 retirements in an entire year. The early retirement wave is hitting other law enforcement agencies across the state. In St. Paul, 24 officers have retired so far this year. The Hennepin County Sheriff's Office lost 11 deputies to early retirement. Neil Melton, president of the Peace Officer Standards and Training Board, says usually about 500 officers across the state retire each year, about 5% of all peace officers in Minnesota.
But we expect, based on the unscientific surveys, that could bump up closer to 15% over the next couple of years.
Melton says what departments lose in experience during a wave of early retirements, they gain in diversity, and not just race and gender. Melton says new recruits often bring a wide range of skills and knowledge to police forces.
We may get people who have been in other professions for years and they're looking for something maybe that's more secure. Perhaps they've been laid off at some point. And so we're seeing officers from age 21 to 41 coming on.
Melton says many of those new police officers come from the armed forces. He says it's common for people with military police experience to jump right into civilian law enforcement. In Minneapolis, Deputy Chief Glampy says military vets make up about half of this year's cadet class. Those cadets will help fill some personnel gaps in the department. Glampy says retirements and other factors have left the department about 80 officers short of its target staffing level. Yet he says residents shouldn't worry that there won't be enough officers on duty to respond to their 911 calls. Glampy says emergency response is the department's highest priority and says officers are routinely moved around the city to make up for areas that are short-staffed. But Glampy says residents should not expect to see new cops on the streets right away.
Because we have application process, we have physical fitness testing, we have oral interviews, we have a very, very stringent background process followed by medical evaluations and psychological evaluations.
Glampy says the whole process can take up to 18 months, so the department started recruiting last year in anticipation of the wave of retirements. The department can save a little training time by hiring police officers who've been working for other agencies. However, Glampy says those so-called lateral hires are rare. The demand for police officers has created a competitive job market, according to Sergeant John Delmonico, head of the Minneapolis Police Federation.
Probably of the 25 cities in the metro area, we're probably like the 12th or 13th in pay. And, you know, if we want to be competitive, then, you know, it's time maybe to look at what we pay our cops and pay us some more so we can recruit and retain those good people.
The starting salary for a Minneapolis police officer ranges from $54,000 to $69,000, depending on how much previous experience the officer has. Glampy says the department expects to hire nearly 100 cops by the end of the year. He estimates about 46 new hires will start working this fall.
Brant Williams in Minneapolis, and that's where Betsy Hodges works. She's the new mayor of Minneapolis. and she came into the studio yesterday to talk with Tom Cran. Here's their conversation.
So let me ask you, 6 months in, what do you think the most significant thing is so far that you've accomplished?
You know, the most significant thing so far has been being able to get a start driving the equity agenda at the city. You know, doing some things early, putting the Cradle to K cabinet together, the Somali Advisory Board together, and asking my department heads as they're making their budget proposals to me for next year, if you had 5% more dollars, what would you do on running the city well? If you had 5% more dollars, what would you do on growing the city? And if you had 5% more dollars, what would you do on equity?
The equity agenda, as you call it, for those who don't remember your campaign in which that was forefront, how do you summarize it when someone asks you, what are you talking about there?
The city of Minneapolis has the biggest gaps between white people and people of color of any city in the country. Employment, education, housing, health, you name it. We are at the bottom of the list. And that has to change.
Right after you were elected, you and I had a conversation on All Things Considered. At the forefront of that, I think it's fair to say, is what is termed, and you've used the term, cradle to K, early childhood programs and development. How do they contribute to closing that gap?
Well, the biggest opportunity and the first opportunity gap a child faces is, are they born healthy? Is their mom healthy while she's pregnant? And is the child born healthy and get that first 2 years of critical brain development? And Aaron Sojourner, a professor here at the University of Minnesota, did a great study showing that if you have the right kinds of interventions in those very, very early years, no matter what happens afterwards, the results, the positive results, persist into high school and beyond. That if you get, if you make sure kids do well in that 0 to 3 time period, you will be ensuring better outcomes for them down the road, no matter what happens next. So we have a cabinet put together to focus on that particular age range. They are charged with putting together that plan.
I want to talk about some recent actions by the city council. You yourself, until just this past January, remember the city council. They've taken action on a number of fronts from, let's say, banning styrofoam containers was one of them, requiring earplugs at places like First Avenue, renaming Columbus Day. And there's been a variety of reaction to that. Some people say, as they say in politics, the term small ball. This is small stuff. That isn't necessarily tied to your agenda. Even the columnist John Tevlin said it's kind of a free-form street dance where everybody's moving to their own loopy tune. Now, you were on the council. What do you make of those recent actions?
Well, I would say a number of them are in line with my agenda. The renaming to Indigenous Peoples Day, very important to the community, and it says a lot about who we are as a city. You know, the zero waste agenda writ large is a very important piece for me. I have someone on my staff who is working on that issue every day. But I would also say I remember when I first started on the city council and I was figuring out what I wanted to get done, how to get it done, and how to work with other people to do it. It takes any council time to figure out and where they're headed. And I would say it's only been 6 months for this new council as well, and I'm really excited about the work we're going to be able to do together moving forward.
I want to talk about the Southwest LRT. And there are 2 weeks remaining until you can make a decision as the city of Minneapolis. I think a lot of people with the price tag of almost $1.7 billion want to know more about what's going on there and when they can expect an answer.
It is completely understandable that people have those questions. It's a very important question overall for the city and for the region. We are, however, in a mediation process, and so I really have to respect the confidentiality of that process and can't reveal details of it.
Should the mediation be done in secrecy here when $1.7 billion public dollars are at stake?
You know, there's a confidentiality to the process that I really need to maintain to make sure that we can have those conversations moving forward. Please understand, I do know how important this is, and it is so important that we need to make sure to maintain the confidentiality of the process.
Coming up, as you outlined in your State of the City address, the first ever bragging week about Minneapolis. And I'm wondering what's at the top of the list as far as you're concerned for bragging about the city.
Well, thank you for bringing it up. Bragging Week is July 14th through July 20th. It's the best week of bragging ever in the city of Minneapolis. Now, whenever I talk about what there is to brag about in Minneapolis, I start with people. We are an amazing, amazing group of diverse, smart, fun people.
What good does the Bragging Week do? Because this is obviously a big part of any mayor's job, is to push the city. But practically, really, what effect does it have?
When site selectors come here, people who are choosing sites for corporations or people who are deciding where to put a convention, when they come here and they take a look around, what they tell us is we are fabulous and our biggest problem is no one knows it.
One of the big news items has been the upcoming Super Bowl to Minneapolis. And a lot of people have said, you know, a lot was given away for that. Do you feel that the state of Minnesota and Minneapolis gave away the store to get the Super Bowl here? And do you think it'll be worth the end result financially, economically, be worth it?
Well, the Super Bowl is a fantastic event. And I was one of the people working to help bring it here. One of the things I did as we were having that conversation is make sure that the taxpayers of Minneapolis were not being asked to foot a huge extra bill, that the host committee itself is going to repay the city of Minneapolis for incremental costs like policing or public works time. And since the agreement with the NFL is with the host committee, you know, we weren't privy to all those agreements that were made.
Should you have been?
Except the parts that related to us. And the parts that related to us are, we are not going to be spending taxpayer dollars on these portions of the event. We're not going to be spending taxpayer dollars. We need that to be reimbursed. And so that's the part that we worked really hard to make sure happened.
You're happy with that?
Yeah. You know, no one is happy with the finances of Major League Sports. I mean, I can't find a person, you know, a person on the street who says, you know, the economics of Major League Sports is something I'm really pleased with and support. That said, if we're going to get the Super Bowl, that's the dynamic that we get to work with. And I did my best to make sure Minneapolis residents were as well represented in that interaction as possible in a way that also allowed us to have this great event in our city.
Mayor Betsy Hodges, thank you for coming over to St. Paul to talk to us. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
And that's Tom Cran from All Things Considered. I'm Phil Picardi, and that's the NPR News Update for the first day of July. News on Wednesday, right back here tomorrow.